are listening to Juno Afternoon. Gunashish for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride, inviting you to settle in for what I hope you'll find a very interesting story, one that goes back to Alaska's territorial days, when people with mental illness were sent out of state for care to Morningside Hospital in Portland, Oregon, never to be seen again. This is something Nisha Steinkruger began to dig into after she retired from her job as a Fairbanks Superior Court judge. It all began with a request for help from her friend Karen Perdue, who she had worked a lot with over the years. Perdue was a former state commissioner for health and social services and at the time served on the Board of Regents for the University of Alaska. Perdue had always wondered what had happened to a relative who went missing after he was sent to Morningside. That sparked Nisha Steinkruger's interest, and the Lost Alaskans Project was born. Years of detective work to track down what happened to her friend's long-lost relative, as well as a long list of other Morningside patients who disappeared. I had a chance to talk with Judge Steinkruger when she was in Juneau looking for clues in court records housed in our state archives. Nisha, tell us what you've been doing since you retired, because it doesn't really seem like you've really retired.
I do have quite a few projects that I come and go on. I was on the Fairbanks Superior Court for 19 years, and then I retired in 2007, and then I did 12 years of what they call pro tem work, which is like a judge being a substitute judge, like a substitute teacher. And that was very enjoyable. I was here in Juneau, I was in Bethel, Nome, all over the state.
When you talk to teachers that are retired but substituting, they give you a real education on education, they say.
I think so. I suspect I could do the same.
That you learn a lot about the judicial system. And, of course, beyond the judicial system, you've been working, you said, on a number of projects. What drew you to these projects?
Well, this particular project, the Lost Alaskans Project, I was drawn to for a couple of reasons. As a Superior Court judge, you do mental commitments at least weekly on a regular basis. Civil ones we call Title 47, and those are cases where someone is a danger to themselves or others, or they are unable to adequately care for themselves in some way. And you do those cases on a regular basis, so you have a pretty good understanding of what's happening in the civil side of mental health, whether or not people's needs are being met. We have kind of different standards in Alaska than many places because people can freeze to death. And so it might be a little different than in Atlanta when we have people that are mentally ill because the safety factor tends to be higher. And then we also have people who commit crimes who are mentally ill. So we're used to, most Superior Court judges, particularly outside of Anchorage, are used to interacting with the mental health system and what's available and not available, and whether or not people are sent to Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So when Karen Perdue contacted me about this kind of work, I was very interested in whether or not what was happening in territorial Alaska with people who were mentally ill was any different than what's happening today.
So when Karen Perdue contacted you, what hat was she wearing?
She was wearing her family hat. She was looking for what had happened to an uncle who she knew had been in and out of Morningside Hospital in Portland, and she was surprised that she couldn't find anything, no list of the Alaskans that had been sent to this mental hospital, no records. This place it's now a parking lot for a shopping mall in Portland. It had burned down, no records were kept, and so she started kind of looking around, trying to figure out who were the Alaskans that were sent to Portland? What happened to them? How many of them
So backtrack
there?
A little bit and tell us about Morningside and how it was probably one of the main providers of mental health for Alaskans at a certain period in our history.
Yes, before statehood, if we say statehood is 1960, prior to 1960, if you were found, the statute provided, if you were found really and truly insane, then a court order was entered and a transportation order, and you were taken outside to Oregon. In the late 1800s, up until about 1903 or 1904, we sent Alaskans to a place called Mount Tabor, Crystal Springs Sanatorium, in the late 1800s, and we sent people also to the Oregon State Insane Asylum, which is kind of interesting because I recently, with another volunteer, found a can of ashes of an Alaskan that have never been claimed that are sitting at the Oregon State Insane Asylum that are still there. So they went to those early places, and then in 1903 or 1904, the Interior Department entered into a contract for Alaska because we were a territory, and the federal government did a contract with an insane asylum in Portland called Morningside Hospital. And it was a private hospital work farm that was owned by a Dr. Henry Coe, C-O-E, and his family. It went under the name of a sanitarium company. And when you see pictures of it, they're publicity pictures. There are vegetable gardens and two-story kind of wooden dormitories, and then big rooms with long rows of beds. And Alaska was their primary source of income, because for every patient sent from Alaska, they got paid by the month. And so it was their basic bread and butter.
So are you hinting that they may not have had incentive to help people get well if Alaskans were the bread and butter?
Yeah. And there was also this feeling you can read in there in some reports that we've seen that this was just such a wonderful place for Alaska's mentally ill and folks that couldn't care for themselves because it was warm and it was cold in Alaska, that this was such a good thing.
Let's backtrack a little bit because you mentioned that the publicity pictures were wonderful. Beautiful farms, people living a healthy, good life, purportedly. How did that image match up with the reality?
It's hard to get a good handle on that, but the Nome Nugget, always a wonderful source of information in Alaska, the newspaper. And there would be letters to the editor where people who from Morningside were writing about the conditions at Morningside. And there was even an investigation by the Nome City Council about what was happening to people from the Nome area. And there were lots of reports of, which was not that different elsewhere in America during these years, but people being tied down, people not being allowed to go to the outhouse, people not being, even though they were growing very healthy food, that the people that lived there were only fed kind of the remnants of the carrots or the remnants of the potatoes because the institution was selling the food that was grown there in other parts of Portland.
So the patients were laborers, a source of cheap labor.
Exactly.
Or free labor, maybe.
Or free labor. And in about 1922, we began sending what were called mentally defective children to Morningside. there's correspondence between Morningside and someone in Alaskan government. I can't remember if it was the governor's office and the Department of Interior about whether or not these quote-unquote defective children could be sent. And Department of Interior said, well, if they're real and truly insane, yes. So bingo, we started sending children that had birth defects, disabilities, not mental health as we
think. So in other words, it was a warehouse for someone who wasn't quote-unquote
exactly
normal. And can I guess that a lot of those children might have been Alaska Natives because
Absolutely. They
were Alaska Natives and not because there was anything wrong with them?
Right. They may have had Down syndrome or epilepsy or birth defects. They may have been deaf. One of the photos that's the most heartbreaking to me is a picture of about 6 Alaska Native children in front of one of the buildings at Morningside. And the label on it says, from the far north, Alaska defectives happily housed in the mild climate at Morningside.
I find Alaska that... defectives?
Yes, yes.
What year was that approximately?
Well, it was sometime, I'm trying to think, in the 30s or 40s probably. I can't remember the date on there, but yes.
So you said that Karen Perdue got you hooked on this when she asked about a relative that disappeared and she never knew what happened. But what drew you further in? Was it these stories?
It was these stories and the thought that there were so many Alaskans, including Alaska Natives, where a mother or a grandmother or a sibling disappeared and they never knew what happened. And as I've traveled across the state, so many times I've run into people that say, oh, I had an uncle that went to Morningside. We don't know what happened. And so I was drawn by those stories, and I was also drawn by comparing what we do today to what we were doing then and whether it was different. And I have to admit that I was also drawn by, eventually Karen tried at the Department of Interior, BIA, census records to establish the names, because we didn't have the names of the Alaskans there, with some success. But my friend Judge Meg Green in Fairbanks and I figured out, oh, I bet there's a court order for each of these people, because I bet the Department of Interior wouldn't pay unless a court ordered them to pay. So we came down here to Juneau and began looking in the archives at big docket books, about 2 feet by about 18 inches, where early Alaskan commissioners, magistrates, and judges hand wrote everything in these big docket books. And we began going through them one by one. And
that sounds like a search for a needle in a haystack.
It was. But, of course, because of the work we've done, we were mesmerized. And we would find cases that said, in the matter of the sanity of Margaret Dawson or whoever. And then we would copy those and we would try and get the names, date of birth. Once in a while, it was just heaven when we would go through and some fabulous clerk of court in Bethel would have gone back to that page, because when someone died at Morningside, a letter was sent back to the court. And some of those great clerks would go back to that page in the docket book and write a note that the person died, their date of birth, what they died from, or sometimes they would staple that letter.
So what did they die from?
Mostly they die from physical old age, physical changes, heart problems, pneumonia, of course, lots of pneumonia. And many of them had diseases when they went there. I mean, we saw a lot of syphilis. that people were sent that had syphilis. We saw a lot of alcoholism. We saw a lot of drug addiction, cocaine.
In the 30s?
Yeah. Prior to 1960, we saw a lot of epilepsy, dementia. We saw a lot of dementia. The youngest person we found was 6 weeks old, and the oldest person was 94 so far.
So what would a six-week-old child, why would they need to go to Morningside?
It's hard to tell, but the only explanation is a birth defect or some kind of disability evident at birth. And the interesting thing about these cases, Rhonda, are every single case there was a jury trial. There were six jurors. Most of them have a physician certificate. Most people were seen by a physician. Now, in those days, physicians didn't know anything about mental health, but a physician certificate. Most of them were represented by a lawyer, and there was testimony taken. Now, the six jurors were six white guys. The judge sent the marshal out, and we were curious if there was any due process.
It's really interesting to have judges go through this stuff because you probably have things jump out at you.
Yes.
That someone who's not trained in the legal process would miss.
Well, when we started seeing that people had a lawyer representing them, we were like, oh my gosh, yeah, look at this. And there was a verdict form. There are actual verdict forms in their record, and they would check the box of whether the person was guilty or not guilty of being real and truly insane. Sometimes we found not guilty verdicts, and that made us smile. You know, it wasn't a complete railroad.
But how interesting that mental health would be portrayed in terms of guilty.
Yes.
Or not guilty.
Exactly. Well, it kind of comes out of the problem, which is the same social problem we have today, which is in the late 1800s, the early federal judges would have these problems where someone was mentally ill, it was cold, they were going to die outside. Local law enforcement picks them up, they put them in the jail, but they can't hold them in the jail because they haven't committed any crime. And nobody will pay for them to be in jail. And so that's the correspondence between the federal government and these judicial officers in Alaska about how to handle these people rather than letting them just die is where this all begins.
So what is the end purpose of your research? Aside from shining a light on what happened, what do you hope to yield from this work?
There's a couple of things. Well, first of all, my heart goes out to the families. And I'd like families who are interested to be able to find whatever happened to their relative. Second, Alaska Native tribes and groups, I think it's important for them to know what happened to their people and how it came about, particularly the children, and be able to reclaim them if they want to. And then I think it's important because it's a piece of the Mental Health Trust. The Mental Health Trust that we have in Alaska was built on the backs of these people, in my view, because...
Well, how so? Because that Alaska at statehood got land. And, of course, that land was tied up for years and years and years, but either the sale or proceeds from those
right.
lands, whatever revenue they might earn in terms of timber, were to go to fund mental health services in Alaska. And, of course, we know that that was decades and decades and decades.
And it didn't happen, right?
Right. So we know that that was a problem for Alaskans, and statehood didn't necessarily solve that. But... how does the Mental Health Trust figure into this story?
In the late 50s, there was a big investigation, and it came out of Oregon, there have been several investigations about treatment of these Alaskans over the years, but there was a very big one in the late 50s in Oregon, and Congresswoman Edith Green in Oregon kind of became the center of it. And if you go back to the papers in Oregon and in D.C., you'll see it on the front page of these papers about these Alaskans in Morningside Hospital. And there were financial questions about how the Coe family, through the General Accounting Office, what they were doing with the money.
What were they doing with the money?
Travel, art. There were a number of things they were spending the money on. And Congress kind of threw up its hands and said, we want out of taking care of Alaska's insane people. Make this go away. We don't want anything to do with it anymore. And that's when you had the Alaska Mental Health Enabling Act. And you had this land. And basically they said, quit taking Alaskans out of Alaska, send them home, give Alaska some land, and tell them to take care of their own insane people. We don't want to hear anymore. In Congress. And it wasn't until 1968 that the last three patients left there. But they started moving them back in 1959 and 60. We didn't have API yet. So the idea was that API would get built.
The Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Exactly. We didn't have the Mental Health Trust. We had the Mental Health Enabling Act, and a trust was supposed to be set up. But as we know now from the litigation, in the 90s, I think, that didn't ever happen. That mental health land was given away or it wasn't properly used. And it wasn't until the lawsuit was filed and litigated and then settled by the state that we had the Mental Health Trust. And part of that was the courts identifying who were the beneficiaries. And in that litigation, they really didn't get all the way back to Morningside. But you can see how those Alaskans that were in Morningside, there was scandal and Congress wanted out. Then it was on those people's backs that the Mental Health Enabling Act came about.
In other words, they paid their dues
exactly.
For those that would follow.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was their abuse that brought attention
and then it wasn't,
to this issue.
Yeah. That happened in the late 50s, and we had statehood, and then the trust never came about, and it wasn't until much later that we, by settlement of that litigation, that we have the Mental Health Trust. But I think of these people as the beginnings, the first people that would have been beneficiaries. I'll digress a minute and say one of the things that's always so interesting to me when I look at these and how many postpartum depressions you can see in some of these cases, you know, where women had been giving birth year after year and they just checked out mentally and they would end up in Morningside. And I have an Alaska Native friend in Fairbanks who told me about her mother going to Morningside and that there were babies at home and that, lucky for them, her dad went to Morningside and got her and brought her back. But she said her mom told her about how when she got there, her mom would just cry and cry and was so homesick and so sad. And another woman told her, you can't let them see you cry. You can't ever let them see you be upset. You have to put on a mask and be happy in your work because only then do you stand a chance of ever leaving here. There's probably a lot of truth to that.
When we come back, more of my conversation with Neisha Steinkruger, and also more about her plans to present her research next month on the Lost Alaskans Project here in Juneau.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Good to have you here with us today. We've been talking with Nisha Steinkruger, who will be in Juno next month to share some of her research on the Lost Alaskans Project. Its mission, to find out what happened to Alaskans who were sent to Morningside Hospital in Portland by court order during the territorial days, when having a mental illness was considered a crime. As a retired judge with deep knowledge of the court system, Steinkruger was uniquely equipped to search state archives for records on Alaskans sent to Morningside. I asked Judge Steinkruger about some of the records that she's uncovered.
This is a little off the track, but I'm looking for this family in southeast Alaska. In 1887, there was a case, and the child's name was spelled, it's Kanakukwa, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's Kanahukwa. And this was, I believe, a six-year-old child. And if you can imagine, in 1887, this child's courageous Alaska Native mother filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court to have her child back from the Presbyterian boarding school in Sitka. I mean, just imagine how much courage that took. And the case actually went to trial. The mother, I think he'd been there 2 or 3 years. Yes, she admits she surrendered him to have him educated. And the judge wrote an opinion, and this is pretty much how the thought was at that time. It said that there's no law compelling the Indians to send their children to school. Moral persuasion is the only weapon in the hands of missionaries. Can parents assign them to a church? The question arises, what is in the best interest of the child? The controlling influence should be, Alaska Indians are dependent allies, and we should educate them. They should be remanded, this child remanded to the superintendent of the mission school, because it's quite obvious that these children must develop sound morals, good order, be in a civilized society. There is no alternative. And I would like to find this Alaska Native family in southeast Alaska, because I would like them to know that this woman who stood up to the federal government and the missionaries and get her child back, which she was unsuccessful at because they decided it was in his best interest to learn all these recitations, study, those kinds of things. I would like this family and the people that are in that group to know how incredibly brave this woman was.
So you said that you've been looking into Morningside, but also looking into boarding schools?
Well, it's just that when you're looking at these records, it takes incredible discipline to only stay on one subject when you're turning the pages. You come along and see other things that have happened to children or people that have difficulty, and you just have to read them. So, yes, boarding schools too. And as you know, that's quite a topic these days, what happened to some children that died at boarding schools.
And so these records may yield some
yes.
answers. And in the case of this woman.
Yes. What a brave, brave Alaska Native woman she must have been.
It's interesting when you look back at the past, you know, you can see with clear eyes that something was wrong.
Yes.
And in our own times, you know, we don't have that kind of clarity. But I suspect that if people 50 years from now look back on these times, they would be shocked.
Yes. Yes. Interestingly, the information is more about people is more available than you would think because it was not confidential. So in the Fairbanks papers, Anchorage papers, Nome, there's daily articles about Mr. So-and-so will be having a hearing at 2 o'clock tomorrow regarding his sanity. And they would be actual news articles in the paper about people. And then there were what I call journey reports in the newspaper because these people had to be taken by dog sled and by sleigh, the Fairbanks to Valdez sleigh in the winter, all the ways to get them to Valdez, to get them on boats, and then take them to Seattle, and then by train from Seattle to Portland. They traveled with a federal marshal and usually with criminal prisoners. They might be in detention after the court ordered them being held for weeks or months.
Well, that's really not unlike today in that when they don't have room at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute or other places, that mental health patients are housed in mm-hmm. detention facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not something that's too far in the past. I mean, I think I remember reading about that about a year or so ago.
Yes. Yes. And so seeing the how many things are not that different than the way we're handling this medical social problem now, it's kind of like the courts tend to be the place of last resort when society doesn't know what to do with a problem.
Or police.
Yes. And so these are, once again, social unit trying to figure out what to do and how to make it happen.
So given that this is a work in progress and there's probably going to be more things that you will turn up, I mean, you have a big stack of documents. I mean, what
yes.
have you amassed?
Yes, and right here in Juneau, over at the archives, you can sit and read these in the court records that are over there. I did this for a long time, and then I have taken about a five-year break. And I'm driving down the road a couple of months ago, and I'm listening to NPR, and there's Dr. Rosita Wuerl from Juneau talking about repatriation of remains, repatriation of artifacts. All of a sudden I go, oh, I know where there are Alaskan remains. So I called her up and said, oh, there are all these Alaska Natives, and they're in four cemeteries in unmarked graves in Portland. So that kind of got me started working again. But I also know that I'm not going to be on the planet forever. And I very much want to pass the torch to another generation of researchers in the Alaska Native community and in the Alaska history community. And I want them to take the next steps, whatever those will be. So I'm going to come back to Juneau in October and do a lecture over at Sea Alaska Institute. I think it's the 6th and the 7th of October. And then I'm going to do a workshop over at the archives for researchers of how to research in the Alaska court records so that people can continue to find these and help others.
So I mean, we could take a couple of attitudes towards this, that this happened long ago, and let's move on.
Right.
Or we could say this might be a window into the present
exactly.
in some way.
Exactly. Our expectations of the justice system to, quote-unquote, handle mental health issues, either when crimes occur or when families and communities are unable to provide for someone with illness, is just this clash between our views about freedom and personal choice and protection, protecting people and safety. So we have this clash about protection and safety and freedom and choice and personal decision making. And we just keep asking the justice system to resolve it. And of course, we can't. It's good for us to see it's been ongoing for so many decades and continue to see how can we shape this and what do we want? What do we want the outcome to be? Because we aren't very successful.
So in wrapping things up, did you find out information about Karen Perdue's uncle, I guess, that disappeared?
Yes, yes.
What happened to him?
He had been released and went back to Morningside and then came back to Fairbanks, so she eventually was able to find that. There's also a family in Fairbanks who found an uncle. They disinterred him and brought him back to be buried with his siblings. And so it brings some peace to those families, I think. And I think that's important. But I guess for me, the bigger picture is more important about where have we been and why we should be teaching the civil rights information in our own history here in Alaska, and what can we learn from it? Can a university student pick one of these people and find out everything they can about them and what happened? And what could that tell us about ourselves and where we are now?
So any final thoughts before we go?
Well, when I came to Alaska, I can remember mental health people doing the little ditty that I didn't understand at the time. And they said you were one of four places if you were Alaskan. You were inside the state, outside Alaska, in Morningside, or suicide. So the ditty went inside, outside, Morningside, suicide. And it wasn't until many years later that I understood what that little ditty
inside,
meant.
Inside, outside, Morningside, suicide. Oh.
Yes.
That should give us a gut punch to hear that.
So I'm hoping that Alaskans will come on October the 6th. I'm going to leave all my papers with See Alaska, and I'm hoping that there are some young researchers, university students, people that want to write a paper. I mean, this has got master's and PhD work written all over it, and that they'll take it and make it part of Alaska's history because it's an important chapter.
It's a missing chapter.
It's a missing chapter.
So thank you for coming to fill the pages of that missing chapter, or at least getting us started. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a conversation that I had with Nisha Steinkruger, a retired Fairbanks Superior Court judge, when she was here in Juneau this summer researching her Lost Alaskans project. When we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Rosita Wuerl, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, about the Lost Alaskans Project and the importance of this research. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for being here with us today. Some early warning radar for you on a presentation coming next month on the Lost Alaskans Project. So mark your calendar for October 6th. The Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is teaming up with Nisha Steinkruger, who's been researching what happened to mental patients and others who were sent to the Morningside Hospital by court order during the territorial days Many were lost forever to their families. I talked with the head of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute about this research. Dr. Rosita Worrell says it's like discovering a missing chapter in Alaska history.
Oh, I mean, I just absolutely could not believe it when she first briefed me on the whole issue. And then to find out that so many of them were Alaska Native people. And then to see some of the letters, one really especially poignant letter was from a young boy wanting his mother back home. And then, you know, this comes on top of the boarding school burials, unknown, you know, our burials of our Native children across the country. And then to find out here at Morningside that we have, who knows how many of our people are buried at those three different sites. They have actually three different sites. And then people just not knowing that their family members are down there. It was just really heart-rending for me to hear it coming on top of the boarding school thing. And then just all the tragedy that our people had to go through. And I know other Alaskans were also sent down to Morningside. I didn't even know at that point in time. Being emotionally not well was considered a crime, and that a judge, a jury could, you know, send them to this distant place. And then when I started looking at some of the names of the people who were left down there, probably some of them are my relatives, names that you and I are very familiar with, names from the Native community across the state. It's just mind-boggling.
So what does this teach us about the times? Is this research sort of a teachable moment for us?
Well, for me, it says we have much more research to do to understand our history. Because we haven't been taught Native history or Alaska history in our schools, it really goes to show how much more we have to learn and how much more research we have to do. And then how in the world do we go about, you know, beginning to bring these people home? Because you know how our people are about our spirits, and our spirits wanting to be home in our own homeland. And just having served 12 years on the NAGPRA Review Committee and hearing Native Americans across the country saying, we have got to bring our relatives home. We have got to bring our ancestors home because this is their homeland. This is where the spirits of our ancestors still reside. So it was overwhelming. And I have to tell you just how much appreciation I have for this retired judge. She is just absolutely devoted to this work, along with her colleagues. And I guess one of them will be coming up with her. I also met someone who's one of her relatives went there, and I'm trying to see if she could come to the October 6th lecture as well.
Boy, there are many revelations as Anisha Steinkruger and other researchers probe the court records, sort of attitudes towards people experiencing mental illness, as well as basic racist attitudes.
Yeah, right. And it's no wonder, you know, it's no wonder that right now, you know, we're still trying to teach and persuade our people that it's all right, you know, to seek counseling. If we come from a history where if you had emotional problems, you were viewed as insane and thrown into these near-light prisons, you can understand our people's reticence about seeking counseling.
Or even afraid of being sent far away from home.
Yes, right.
If you ask for help. So,
right.
So one of the things that Anisha is hoping is that Sea Alaska Heritage Institute can carry on the research she started. Are you looking at doing that?
Well, let me tell you that there are so many research projects that we have to do. And what we're trying to do is encourage graduate students who are beginning their graduate research work to come and look at or talk to us. Because we're compiling a list of research areas, and we're trying to open up new research areas like traditional ecological knowledge. I mean, the knowledge that Native people have accumulated over thousands of years, science is just now beginning to realize that there is some value in native knowledge. I mean, just look at California, the Indians, and how they controlled fire down there. Scientists are now looking at their approaches. So yes, I'm hopeful that we will be able to find people who will continue this research. I mean, I know she's done a lot of work, and I truly appreciate all the work she's done. So, but it has to be carried on.
You know, my sense of it is, too, that there's some overlapping things that we can learn from that shed light on other areas, like how Alaska Natives were dealt with in the criminal justice system, the lack of cultural understanding. Do you think that there's a lot of potential to use this project to help support other research?
Oh, absolutely. You just remind me of some of the research work that was done in the 80s where we found out that Native people were getting sentences that were twice as long as non-Native people for exactly the same crime. The state of Alaska at that time, you know, tried to do something about it. They set up sentencing guidelines. And, you know, that was an effort to deal with the inequity and the discrimination in the sentencing. We need this data. If we're going to make changes, we have to bring the hard data forward and let people know that these kind of injustices still exist in Alaska and in our country. I just saw the latest statistics on the incarceration rate of Alaska Natives. Alaska Natives are only 14% of the population, but we represent 41% of the population who are incarcerated. And we need to go back and look at that and find out what were the causes. Do we have the same kind of inequities, you know, that we saw during the 80s where Native people were getting sentences that were twice as long? And we only looked at one element in that case, the sentences. But there's a whole process through the legal system where inequities could exist.
So with this particular presentation, who do you recommend attend this?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm hopeful that Native people who may have recollections of their ancestors being sent away, just like I met this one person, and I'm inviting her down to come. And then, of course, I think all Alaskans should be concerned, because it's not just Alaska Natives that were interred at Morningside and at these three different cemeteries. So I'm hoping that all Alaskans, but the other thing is we're going to have to figure out how do we begin to address this. That means that we're going to have to persuade some governmental entity to help us out. I see that our Secretary of Interior, she's already jumped into the boarding school program of children who are buried outside in these boarding schools. I'm hoping, you know, that she might also take a look and say, maybe we should also be looking at hospitals like Morningside.
What do you think we can learn from the Morningside story that can help us today with regards to mental health?
Well, I think the first recognition that it is mental health, that you're not just a criminal. And we certainly know that our communities, our population still continues to suffer from trauma that manifests itself in multiple different ways. You know, I just think we have our work cut out for us, Rhonda.
Well, I wonder, too, if some of the problems that the research turned up, are they still going on today?
Yeah, that's the question that needs to be asked. Mm-hmm.
Because we still have, in our state, high rates of suicide.
Oh, gosh, yes. Mm-hmm. I think we have the highest in the nation. I haven't looked at the latest numbers, and it hasn't seemed to improve.
So before we go, any thoughts?
Oh, well, I just want to say that I'm just so grateful that we have people like our retired judge and her colleagues who I think are doing the right things. And I still believe that we have many good people out there who are wanting justice, and I applaud them. I can't tell you how much I appreciate their efforts.
And that was Dr. Rosita Worrell, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Well, that'll do it for Juno Afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Have a great evening.